Good evening. Welcome to the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection. My name is Adam Hamilton. I'm the senior pastor here, and it's a joy to welcome you tonight. Thank you so much for being here for this healthcare forum, and we want to welcome those of you who are joining us online as well. We know there, at least we hope there are tens of thousands of people who are joining us online, and we want to say thank you for joining us. We're in Leawood, Kansas, which is a suburb of Kansas City, and we just appreciate you tuning in. And I want to say just a few words about what we're doing this evening before we get started. Some of you may be wondering, why is a church hosting a forum on healthcare reform? And so I want to answer that question just briefly. And I want to say that from the earliest of times, Christians considered care for people who were sick and dying a part of the gospel. It was a gospel imperative. They followed Jesus Christ, who himself devoted his short life, to healing the sick. So in Matthew's gospel, when it summarizes Jesus' ministry in Matthew 9, 35 through 36, it says that Jesus went through all their towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. And when he saw the multitudes, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. In Luke's gospel, when Jesus tells us that what God really longs for from human beings is to love God with all our heart, and to love our neighbors we love ourselves, that loving our neighbors we love ourselves has something to do with being concerned for people who are sick. So when he went to illustrate that, he told the parable of the Good Samaritan. And in that parable, there was a Samaritan who found a Jewish man who'd been beaten and left for dead on the side of the road, and he stopped to help him. And he bandaged his wounds, and then he provided for his ongoing care. And so for Christians, there was no question, caring for people who were sick was an important part of our gospel. And so from the earliest days, that was an important part of what Christians did. And so we still care about what happens to people who are sick and people who are in need. Now, we're sponsoring this forum not only because we think this issue of care for people who are sick matters, but we're also sponsoring it because this is currently one of the most controversial issues facing our country, and we're really polarized over this in our country. And as a church, we've sort of staked out a place where we try very hard to listen to people from all sides of an issue. And in listening to them, we try to hear the truth on each side, and we try to build bridges. That's a little of who we are at Church of the Resurrection. And so in the midst of this conflict, even among Christians, we thought maybe there's a place for us to invite people from very divergent points of view to come and share their perspectives on healthcare reform. We're also a church that believes the gospel relates to every part of life, and including the issues that are facing us in our country today. Now, the aim of this forum is to help us better understand the issues that have called many to work for healthcare reform, the various solutions to the problems, and to help each of us have a better understanding of positions other than our own. So our goal for you is not only to come in here and you already know what you believe and then you walk out the door, you know, further understanding what you believe, but that you might also understand what other people think about this issue. But to do that, we have to listen carefully. It's not enough to be formulating our arguments against what people are saying, but to actually stop and to hear what each of these persons behind me has to say from their various points of view. Now, this is a remarkable group of people. And none of them are politicians. This is not a town hall meeting. You can't throw anything at them. You can't, I'd like for you to be gracious and kind. Most of you are Church of the Resurrection members. And I want you to treat each of these people who are sitting up here with great respect. They've given up an evening and some time thinking about what they're going to be talking about. And I want you to show the respect that's due to them. And so when it comes time for somebody to speak and somebody says something you disagree with, I'm going to ask you to bite your tongue and just to listen. When somebody says something you agree with, I'm going to ask you to sit on your hands, and you can quietly nod your head if you want, but no amens, no that's right, no, you know, clapping or anything else. And if you find you just can't hardly stand to be quiet during this whole thing, we'll just invite you to go out and have a free cup of coffee right outside here. We have a TV set up out there, and you can just shout at that TV all you want. You can clap and shout amen all you want to, but do that out in the narthex because we really feel like it disrespects others. Even when you're saying something affirmative about one person, you're saying something else about someone else. So we're going to ask. That's some of the ground rules we're going to have. And I know that you'll respect those. You're a great group of people. We hope to leave having discovered some common ground today. But we're not going to agree on the solution. And hopefully we will leave here having a sense of why other people may hold views different than our own. Finally, we're going to model civil dialogue and discussion so that other people might see what that looks like. And maybe there might be others who will do the same, do what we're doing here tonight. Now, I'd like to take a moment to introduce you to the people who are our panelists today. And again, some of them are members of our church, some not, but they're all people who are respected in their fields. Sam Turner, who is the CEO of Shawnee Mission Medical Center. Sam, we're grateful that you're here today. Myra Christopher, who is the president and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics here in Kansas City. Keith Wisdom, who is CFO of United Healthcare in Midwest region, and he is also the chair of our finance committee at Church of the Resurrection. Thank you for being here. And Keith was my partner in crime in organizing this, so thank you for helping in get this together. Hilda Fuentes is a hero here in Kansas City in what she does, and she heads up the Sam Rogers Healthcare Center and does a magnificent job. They provide care for people, a wide array of people in Kansas City. And your main offices are 8th and Euclid, if I remember correctly. Rick Colley is a president of Lockton, and it's actually the Lockton Kansas City group, which provides health benefits for people here in Kansas City. And Rick, we really appreciate you being here. Thank you. Brenda Sharp, who's the CEO of Reach Health Foundation, and they're involved and engaged in issues related to health for people, in particular for people on the margins. And Dr. Rich Richardson, who is an ER physician at Shawnee Mission Medical Center in St. Luke South. He's the director of medical services for Johnson County Emergency Services, and he heads up our CART team here at Church of the Resurrection. So would you join me in giving a welcome to these folks? Each of these persons represents a stakeholder in this debate. Each brings their own biases. Each looks at the same data, but they see it in slightly or sometimes radically different ways. And from them, we're going to have a chance to learn tonight. Our format is we'll be asking questions. Dr. Bill Reed, who is head of the Department of Cardiovascular Disease at KU Med Center, is going to be joining me and asking questions. I'll ask the first few, and then he and I will go back and forth. Those questions, these folks will have 3 minutes to answer. That's not a lot of time, but that gets us out of here in an hour and a half. And they have a clock right up here, and it says when their time is done, and we're going to stop them. And so with this in mind, and before we do anything else, let's spend a moment in prayer. Would you bow with me? Lord, when you walked this earth, you healed the sick. We believe this indicated a concern you have for people who are suffering with illness and disease, that your heart goes out to them. As a nation, we're divided. Not over whether healing the sick is a good thing, but how health care is offered and paid for in this country, the role of government in the health care system, and a host of other issues. We pray that you would use this forum tonight to help us better understand the issues in this debate and to consider solutions. Bless each of our panelists and help them to help the rest of us think about this important issue. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, now for the first question. 85% of all Americans, and this question is for all of you, but I'm going to begin with Keith Wisdom. He'll answer it first, and then each of you will have a chance. We'll go from Keith to Sam, and we'll work our way around the panel. 85% of all Americans have health insurance. For most of these, the system seems to be working. Yet each of you have indicated that you believe some kind of reform is needed. What is not working in our current system, actually, this is the question. What is not working in our current system, or put another way, what needs to be reformed and why? Keith?
Thanks, Adam, and thanks everyone for coming tonight. There are healthcare and improving healthcare is something I'm passionate about, and there are three topics I'm going to address here. The first one has to do with the number of uninsured, and I think there's general consensus that we have too many uninsured people, and that's one of the problems to solve. So my first slide speaks to data straight from the U.S. Census Bureau. It's straight from the primary source, and it indicates that there's...
We're waiting for the slide to come up, those of you back in the production room. Keith is going to start telling jokes here in a second until those...
That would be
all right. We may not have the slide right now, so you might just
anyway,
go ahead and tell us.
There's 46 million people, and there's been various numbers thrown around out there, but in general, it's around 46 million people. This is 2007 census data. 2008 was pre-released, just high level. Still 46 million, but we know we had a downturn in the economy this year, so we would expect that 2009 is much higher than that number. These categories below here helps us understand what makes up the 46 million, and it's not a value judgment on that they're not, that they have health care or they're not important, because all 46 million people do not have health insurance. 9.7 million are not U.S. citizens, and the current agreement in Washington between Republicans and Democrats is that those people aren't going to be solved for in this health care reform legislation that's going to go forth. I would say that's a moral issue to-do list item it's not going to be solved. Household incomes greater than 50,000, 17.6 million people. The idea there is at some point people have enough income. I don't know that 50,000 is the right measurement, but at some point people have enough income that they should be able to buy insurance, and they're making a value judgment of how to spend their money. And then also in that 46 million, this is from a Kaiser Family Foundation Urban Institute research, estimated around 11 million people actually are qualified for Medicaid or SCHIP coverage and for some reason or another aren't insured, have not enrolled in it. That would take us down to 7.3 million, but that grossly understates the problem because some of those categories up above have overlap because there would be U.S. citizens that have income greater than 50,000. And there would be, of the people who have reasonably high incomes, there'd be people who have pre-existing conditions and couldn't get coverage, or the coverage that they could get because of their health status would be so expensive that even at their income level, they could not afford it. So the number is greater than 7 million. I've made an estimate of 9 to 14 million. To be honest, we have differences of opinion sitting up here on stage, and we don't know what the exact number is. But that kind of frames what the number of uninsured citizens who cannot afford health insurance that that what Congress is trying to solve. And my time's running short. Let me move quickly.
Chief, I'm going to give you 30 extra seconds because it took a while to get the slides up.
Okay. So. We'll go to Medicaid. Next slide, please. Medicaid and SCHIP. Medicaid is for, it's a state-federal partnership, shared funding. Low-income people, the elderly, and people with disabilities get coverage. State Children's Health Insurance Program is what SCHIP stands for, and it covers at higher levels of income children than the adults that get covered in Medicaid. Go to the next slide. How do we determine who is, or how do the states determine in federal government who's in Medicaid and SCHIP? And it's based on federal poverty level definitions. For 2009, if you're a single person, a one-person family, federal poverty level, 100% of federal poverty level is $10,830. Family of four, that's around $22,000. Next slide. And this is when I got on the Purchaser Council of the Kansas Health Policy Authority back in 2007. And prior to that, I just assumed that Medicaid took care of our poorest individuals, gave them health insurance and coverage for what they needed. And what I found out was is it doesn't cover near the number of people at the levels of income that you would expect that it covers people. And this slide shows in Kansas, Missouri, and U.S. averages who is covered by Medicaid. And this says that if you're an adult without children, that it doesn't matter how poor you are, you cannot be on Medicaid if you're able-bodied. The second item, if you're a working parent, family of four, if you're in my situation and you make more than $7,497 in a year, you cannot get Medicaid in Kansas. Obviously, those people are very much worried about just putting food on the table, not about paying health insurance premiums.
And Keith, I'm going to stop you there. I think we'll come back to these numbers, I know, later on. Thank you very much. I'm going to go to Sam Turner now and ask Sam, what's the problem? What needs to be fixed in health care reform?
Well, I don't think we would be talking at all about health care reform if there weren't escalating costs. And I think that is one of the main reasons that we're having this discussion. And, of course, there's also – so when you look at 85% of Americans covered and you wonder, well, what is the problem? And it's because even for those who are covered by insurance, the costs are continuing to go up because of that cost of being shifted to the individual, higher deductibles. And then there's the other issue of the 15%. 15% in a country like this, that's a tremendous problem to have when 15% of folks don't have coverage. This lack of coverage and escalating costs is probably precipitated by the fact that we don't have incentives for preventive care. Most of the money goes into treating illnesses rather than preventing them. Access to primary care for poor, the almost poor, defensive medicine. We have a tort system that creates an environment that for hospitals and physicians often practice defensive medicine, which greatly escalates costs. And then we have also a payment system where it really de-incentivizes physicians to even go into primary care as a practice, and that's just exacerbating the problem.
All right, very good. Myra?
Well, Keith has talked about access and Sam has talked about cost. And often people talk about a third issue, and that's quality. And I think that very few people would argue that we are getting what we're paying for. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and our outcomes data just don't measure up with countries that are spending much, much less. But my reason for accepting the invitation tonight is really that at the Bioethics Center, our concern is primarily about an issue that very rarely gets to the table, and that is about justice, about equity and fairness for all people in this country. Aristotle said that a just society is one where the benefits and the burdens of a society are shared by all people. And at this point in our country, those of us who have access to good health care, affordable health care for us, do so really on the backs of the poor. We are unable to do that in large part by the fact that we are willing to turn our head to the fact that there are about 46 million people in this country who don't have access to insurance and another 25 million who are grossly underinsured. So I'm here tonight to bring that perspective to the table.
Thank you very much. Hilda?
Well, I work in a community health center, and we see over 20,000 patients a year. 70% of those patients don't have any type of medical insurance, and I have yet to see an adult come through our door that has any type of Medicaid coverage. The people come to us and they are sick. They have to make a decision whether or not they're going to put food on the table, put shoes on their children's feet, or buy them clothes for school. And that's the reality of life for many people that we may not encounter every day. And at the same time, we have people who can't afford their medications. I'm insured. My medications cost me almost $1,000 a month. How many of you can say the same thing? I'm sure there are many of you out there that have diseases and illnesses that cost you quite a bit of money. So insurance is not necessarily the answer to our burdens. And so there has to be an option. The elderly, our senior citizens may have Medicare, and they still walk away with large medical bills. The very poor, and I mean the very poor, may have Medicaid, and then you have the middle class, or those of us who are working every day, and all of us are one step away from medical bankruptcy. We can lose our jobs, our partners can lose our jobs. We know what has happened in terms of the recession. We have more and more people coming to our health center who were once upon a time gainfully employed. There are people who absolutely refuse to enroll in Medicaid because they have pride. We will always have people who have a very deep sense of pride and do not want to take something for nothing. And we have to honor and respect those options that people want for themselves. But there is a great unmet need. Our health insurance today is born on the backs of employers. It is the employers that are providing insurance for people. And that is something that our employers are no longer willing to bear. More and more of the costs are being shifted to families. $50,000, while it may be a lot, if you're raising a family and you're paying over $1,000 a month for your cost of the insurance, does not go a very long way. And so there has to be options for those individuals who cannot afford to pay the cost of health insurance or to keep them or their families well. If you do not have health, you really don't have much of anything.
Thank you, Hilda. Rick?
Thanks for the opportunity to be here this evening with you. And Adams has asked us to lay the challenges, and I think later we'll talk about solutions, and reasonable minds certainly will disagree about the solutions. But I'd like to piggyback on something Adam asked, that there's a lot of complexity, there's a lot of confusion about terminology. And if I may ask for the first slide, please, demonstrated no greater than by these individuals. Next slide, please. I think these are amongst the most confused people in the dialogue, that euthanasia will kill your grandma. who are those kids, I wonder? Next slide, please. I'd like to spend just a few minutes talking about the affordability issue, and Sam has rightly touched on this issue as it relates to individuals. Hilda represented this as it relates to the employer community, and I'd like to add to that in the scope of our country. And I think we need to be mindful of both the amount of money that's currently being spent in the healthcare system. We project to spend $40 trillion in the next decade. I would certainly hope that we could create some efficiencies within that system and that that may be a sufficient amount of dollars. And secondly, I have two children that I am very concerned about leaving an insurmountable debt to. And while we all inherited this problem to some degree, I think it's our responsibility to be cognizant of it. This is the U.S. debt clock that's running. These are real numbers, or close to real numbers. Up top it shows the U.S. debt, which is currently $11.7 trillion. And if I could ask the folks to scale down in this, equally or perhaps more concerning is this line, and I don't know if you can see it very well, but it lists the unfunded liabilities that we have as a country. Those numbers are somewhat difficult to see, but second line from the bottom, there's about $59 trillion in commitments that we have made to individuals that are not funded. So some may say, you know, Medicare is going broke in 8 years, Social Security is going broke in 5 years. I would contend we're broke today, and these numbers back this up. Of that almost $60 trillion in debt, almost 40 of it is in Medicare and Medicaid, almost 11 of it's in Social Security, and $8.5 trillion we've accumulated in debt in the RX for Seniors program. Next slide, please. To me, trying to get my arms around $1 trillion is a very difficult concept, so maybe this is helpful. This is $1 million in $100 bills. Next slide, please. There's $100 million. Next slide. $1 billion. Next slide. There's $1 trillion. So again, back to my original point, I would contend that with $40 trillion, we ought to be able to do better. Next slide, please. I'll touch real quickly on one other topic that we will get to later, and that is individuals and our responsibility in this conversation as consumers of healthcare. Very quickly, this shows from 1985 to 2007 the increase in obesity across the country.
Rick, I'm going to stop you there, and we'll come back to that because that is one of our questions later on. Thank you very much. Brenda?
I just want to share a quick story, if I could, with your congregation and the members of the public who attend tonight, and I thank you for coming out on this discussion. I want to, again, express our thanks to Adam for engaging in this very important conversation. But here's how health care for poor and uninsured works for people in, I'll just say, Kansas. It works for people this way in a lot of the area of the country. But you probably have heard of the Kansas Mission of Mercy. This is a group of dental providers that every year assemble, and they provide free dental care across various locations of the state. They had one out at Kansas Speedway in 2003. You may recall some of the lines for that care. This year, the event was held in Manhattan. By 5:30 a.m. on the day of the event in February, cold February, more than 1,000 people were in a line that stretched a quarter of a mile to get services. By the end of the two-day event, 1,700 patients had been treated. 2,900 teeth were pulled. And if you've ever volunteered an event like this, to see that many teeth in buckets will change your life. 1,700 fillings were put in. And I think when I volunteered at a K-MOM event in Wichita several years ago, it was frankly a life-changing event for me in my work with the Reach Healthcare Foundation. I had an idea of who needed healthcare in this country and who wasn't getting it. And when I saw a 10-year-old little boy in the pediatric unit where I was volunteering, who had sat up all night with his three brothers and his parents, had waited in the cold in line to get in, and when he came in to our unit, he had four teeth extracted, 10 years old. They were permanent teeth. He had abscesses in his mouth. And he smiled at me when he was done, and he had gauze hanging out of his mouth, blood everywhere, and he was so happy. He was happy because he wouldn't be in pain anymore. He was happy that he could concentrate in school. And I stopped and I thought, where are we? This is America. This is essentially a third world country kind of option that we are providing, at least in this case with dental care, but I would argue that we're doing that in other areas of healthcare as well. And again, I think that one of our issues at the Reach Healthcare Foundation that we try to address through grant making and convening and other activities is to make sure that all folks, regardless of whether they carry around a laminated card in their pocket, have access to quality health care. And I think that we can get there. Whatever we come up with will be a uniquely American approach. And I'm so happy that we're here having this dialogue tonight with my very esteemed colleagues who had quite a robust discussion before we even came out. And
yes, we did. Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you.
All right. Dr. Richardson.
Adam, thank you that I went last on this question because it's pretty well been covered to this point. To me, this is a spiritual issue. I think about Jesus. And if you think about Scripture, what was his main ministry? Wasn't it healing? Yes, I mean, his teaching has changed all our lives, but it was his healing. That's what drew people to him initially, his just the touch of his garment, and they were healed. So, and then the Good Samaritan is maybe the greatest proverb of all the New Testament. So this is a spiritual issue. And when we have people in the United States that come to me with tears in their eyes to say, will you please take care of me? I was just turned away by an urgent care because I don't have insurance. We have a problem. But we also have a problem in the United States that we have unrealistic expectations. We want the finest health care in the world. But with that comes a price tag. With all due respect, we are doing our very best to give the finest health care. If, heaven forbid, you were to have breast cancer, your chances of surviving if you're in the United States are higher than it is if you're in Great Britain. So it depends on how you look at those statistics as far as the quality of health care. We have to have realistic expectations. There's a price tag for what we ask for. And we as Americans need to see ourselves more as consumers, that we're purchasing a product. What I mean by that is this, is that when you have health insurance, you tend to think, well, okay, I'll just go to the hospital because my insurance will pay for it. And you don't really shop around. You don't have certain expectations of quality. But suddenly now, if you are see yourself as a consumer, then suddenly that starts changing. You might start looking more for appropriateness of care. For example, a health savings account. If you have a certain amount of money to spend every year, you don't spend that money, then you have that money left at the end of the year. So then you choose your health care more appropriately, or maybe you don't use it as much. I will say that many of my feelings go along with Sam in the fact that we have to have tort reform. Now, you probably expected to hear that from a physician, but I'm here to tell you that in the emergency department, when I see you for only 2 to 3 minutes at a time, I have to make a lot of judgments in a very short time. And with that pressure, with that circling around of the possibility of malpractice at any second, it forces me to maybe over-treat, order tests, or care for you in a very expensive manner. With that, also with that, just that constant annoyance. Yes, there's always got to be an accountability physician, but until we get a grip on tort reform, I don't think you'll ever see a physician, at least in the emergency department or the other critical care services, being able to dial down their provision of care.
Rich, I'm going to stop you there. You've got 2 seconds left, but I'll give you an extra 2 seconds on the next answer. Because you've started into my second question, and that is, how do we fix it? What do you think are the most important things that we need to do to reform health care? And you've started with tort reform, and I'm going to give you the chance to start first here with whatever else you'd like to suggest we should be doing. What should we be addressing in health care reform?
Okay. I do not think tort reform is the most important. I think that is one fact of it. Americans have to become more accountable for their own health. You cannot expect your physicians, your nurses, to make you healthy if you don't take ownership for your own health. We have the issue now with obesity, with alcoholism, with smoking, and these are things that we can get a handle on. But when I have someone come into my emergency department that's angry at me because I don't have their breathing turned around quick enough, and yet I look in their hands and their nicotine-stained hands, there is only so much I can do there. So we have to take ownership. I think we have to take more responsibility for our own health. Everybody on the face of the earth is God's children. When I look at a patient, there is the image of Christ, and I always do my very best to believe that. But having said that, we also have a system here that cannot handle the influx of people coming into this country. We have hospitals in our southwest states that are closing their emergency departments because they're going bankrupt. When we have people coming over the border in active labor with a paper in their hand, directions, if you go to this American hospital, say this, but because of their laws, they will take care of you, and then you will be able to stay there for care. We're going to do our very best to care for people, but that is something we have to get a handle on. Those are, I guess, the ones that immediately come to mind. There's this so many, but I would leave it at that.
Brenda, what needs to be fixed?
Thanks. Our foundation hasn't taken a specific position on any health reform proposal, but our guiding principles, I think, bear noting. We begin with our core belief that all people deserve access to quality, affordable health care. And I think some of the info that Keith shared earlier bears some repeating. Contrary to perception, Medicaid does not provide coverage for all low-income people. In 43 states, including Kansas, adults without dependent children cannot qualify for Medicaid, even if they are penniless. In Kansas, the only way to qualify for Medicaid is if you're a parent, pregnant, elderly, or disabled. So again, if you're an adult, no kids, and you're poor, there's not an option for you. Even then, the eligibility level is frighteningly low, and our numbers differ a little bit, but for low-income parents, a family of four in Kansas can earn no more than about $5,600 a year to qualify for Medicaid in Kansas. That's $469 a month. I would dare say that most of the members of this particular congregation probably have house payments that are nearing the $5,000 mark over a couple of months. And so for us to put that into perspective about the choices that you make, healthcare is probably not going to be one of those, or health insurance. We think that any reform proposal should address quality, cost, and accessibility, as the other panelists have referred. But from our foundation's perspective, we also want to see reform models that address comprehensive coverage, primary care, specialty care, oral health care, and mental health care. Oral health and mental health are conveniently overlooked, although everything that comes into our body passes through our mouth, and we use our brain every day, and we know that the numbers of people struggling with mental illness are staggering. And in this country, for whatever reason, the way the medical professions have developed, we tend to bifurcate the treatment of those areas. So we treat the body in one set of medicine, and we treat the mouth in another, and we treat the brain in yet another. And we think that it's really important that reform proposals start to acknowledge that we are human bodies. We are all of our parts are interrelated, and we need all of those to function well to live a full and healthy life.
Rick?
I'd like to reform the reimbursement structure, and the primary reason is the primary care physician shortage is about to get exacerbated. And while it is absolutely a noble cause to increase access to care, that will simply exacerbate the existing PCP shortage that we have. And PCP means primary care providers, primary care physicians, which I think everyone would agree is the most efficient way to administer care, to have your care quarterbacked by a primary care provider. A significant percentage of those individuals, though, now are in the last 5 years of providing those services, and only 5 to 10% of incoming medical students are going into primary care. And the reason for that is there's simply not enough money to justify the opportunity cost they have in education and the couple hundred thousand dollars in debt that they come out with. If you're coming out with $250,000 in debt and you're going to get paid $100,000 in the first year, it just doesn't make sense. So those individuals are doing what most of us would do. They're gravitating towards the specialty type care where the investment and the reward are better aligned. So if I had one thing to do, I would modify our reimbursement system to put more financial incentive towards the primary care delivery system.
Very good. Hilda?
You would think that I was on the end because they had such great answers, which, of course, were all of mine. You know, there was a comment earlier about undocumented or illegal people in our country. And, of course, our country was built on people coming here and have, in fact, made this country what it is today. And it, in fact, is a great country. But as it relates to health, the individuals that are here that are undocumented, because I work with a lot of those individuals who come to our health center, particularly the children, they sit right next to your children in the schools, and they are playing in the very same playgrounds. And whatever illness that they may catch, whether it be the common cold or whether it might be a very devastating flu, or one of the diseases that could have been taken care of through an immunization, they're going to pass on to one of your children. And so it is so important that when we think about these issues, that we put on the eyes of Christ. God said, Jesus said, whatever you do to the least of these, you also do unto me. In the Old Testament, the Jewish people were told to open up their farmland, the borders of their farmland, every 7 years, and to let the aliens come in so that they would have food. The individuals that we're talking about are human beings, flesh and blood, with the same needs and the same heart and soul that we have. And there is a cost, but when it comes to the health of a child or a mother or a father, it takes away their non-identity. They are not running away from a mansion. I have individuals that come to our health center who have spent their entire lives in not concentration camps, but refugee camps. That's all they've known until they came to the United States.
Hilda, I'm going to pause you there since your time is up, but thank you. Keith?
Similar to Hilda, a lot of the great ideas have already been talked about, but going back to the slides I'd presented earlier, one of the, let me step back. I do work for UnitedHealthcare. I am a part of United Health Group, and I'm not trying to portray my company's stances on these issues, so these are my personal opinions that I'm sharing with you tonight. But as far as solutions, I think there's significant opportunities here. One would be expanding Medicaid and SCHIP and some other government programs to help the truly needy so that those are funded and cover up to an adequate income level. And then even beyond those levels, and there's opportunities to reform Medicaid and improve upon that. Similar to what Rick said, there's inefficiencies in our system. And I'm not going to get into details on that sort of thing, but we really have an opportunity to expand our safety net insurance programs. And then even above that level, there's going to have to be a transition where we help support, the government helps support paying for premiums once we get above the level covered by Medicaid. And because once you get to $25,000, you don't automatically have enough money to pay your full premium just because you reach that income level. So there's going to have to be a graduated scale to help support that. And I think those are all important things as kind of a foundation just to start healthcare reform. The second thing, the health insurance industry back in December, before it became a political hot potato, put together a reform proposal where, and it's sponsored by the America's Health Insurance Plans, AHIP, where the insurers are willing to take all individuals, regardless of pre-existing conditions or health status, charge them the same as other members of the health insurance plans, and so that the pre-existing condition that has and the poor health status that have prevented many people from getting insurance, that problem would go away. Now, anyone familiar with insurance, you have to have a risk pool that has healthy and sick people in order to balance out and to be able to finance health care, because that's what insurance is about. It's financing health care. And so with that, we would need all individuals to be in the health insurance pool, which most people have talked about. The only practical way is mandates, and I know mandates are controversial, but it's one practical private solution in order to get everybody that has pre-existing conditions the opportunity for insurance is by putting everybody in health insurance, requiring everybody to have health insurance, and then that problem is solved. Rick talked about improvements in the health system, and I don't have time to go into some ideas, but there's certainly billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars of opportunity over the next 10 years if we tackle the right reforms, and maybe I'll have time in a future 3 minutes to talk about this.
Thank you, Keith. Myra?
You know, the good news is I think we've got a lot of agreement about this. I think that everyone agrees, as Keith is saying, that we have to have significant insurance reform. We've got to figure out a way to get everybody insured, and there are things that have to happen with regard to making that possible. I think also that we agree that we have to have some changes in the system. We need to start looking at comparative effectiveness research. We want to be spending our money on the right stuff, so we're buying wisely. I don't think anyone wants to argue about that. I think everybody agrees we need more health information technology. We need to be able to talk to one another in a rational way. We need better incentives for people in the workforce so we have more primary care providers and so forth. And we have a lot of agreement about we need more responsibility among individuals. We need to be responsible for our health, our wellness. We need to take preventive measures, and we need to do things like advanced care planning, so at the end of our lives, people aren't trying to guess what we would want and really doing that crazy exercise that sometimes we get into. But, you know, I run a center for practical bioethics, so we're interested in the practical part of this, but we're also interested in the philosophical part of this. And I think the thing that really has to happen is that somehow we have got to figure out how to move the conversation from what I want to what we need. And I will say I have been disheartened by some of the rhetoric around this about, well, will I lose this? Well, what will it mean to my premium? What will it mean to, without any regard to the people that Hilda has spoken so passionately about, without any regard to people who have pre-existing conditions and can't get health care, without any regard to the people that Brenda has talked about, the working poor who, due to no fault of their own, simply cannot afford to play and participate at this point. So I really think that, Adam, as I said to you when we were having dinner, that forums like this and within the faith community, what better place for us to begin to thinking about the communal rather than just the individual? So I'm so grateful that you're doing this.
Thank you, Myra. Sam?
Yeah. I believe that this whole situation cannot be solved with the current rhetoric that's going on, the failure to sit down and discuss this and be open about these issues. And I believe also that anyone within our borders ought to be covered to some extent. Myra, I've not heard the conversations. I guess I run in the right crowds with people who are worried about what they're losing. I've not heard that. But what I have heard people talk about is, how are we going to do all of this without raising taxes, without spending even more trillions of dollars. And I think that's because the conversation has not totally been honest. And that's the R word, rationing of health care. You know, people want to say there won't be rationing of health care, but there is going to have to be a different way of doing things, and that can be defined as rationing. Rationing has been going on in health care since 85, when the government decided that you couldn't stay in a mental health unit as long as you did before because they weren't going to pay for it, or insurance wasn't going to be pay for it. So a decision was made, 7-day stays, 14-day stays, and it got so bad that most hospitals now don't even have a mental health unit. We are one of the hospitals that do have an inpatient mental health unit because it's very difficult to justify it from a financial standpoint. We're in wealthy Johnson County. 25% of the children born in our OB unit don't have insurance. A significant portion of those mothers just happen to be driving by when they become pregnant. And I'm not being disparaging, because what it means is that we are doing the right thing, because they feel that they can come to Shawnee Mission Medical Center and be treated the way everyone else is. But it's a fact. Dr. Richardson will tell you that a huge percentage of the folks who come to our emergency department don't have insurance, and it gets bigger and bigger. No one is turned away. No one loses their home. All, you know, because there are compassionate hospitals throughout this country. But the fact remains that if everyone receives exactly the same kind of care that we have been receiving over the years, we may not have enough dollars to handle it. So I do think there has to be discussion about what is appropriate care and can we afford the way we're doing business now.
All right. Okay, we are halfway through with our time, and what I'm going to do is give us a 5-minute opportunity for you to stand and turn to a couple people around you and say, here's what I've heard so far, and that'll give us a chance to catch our breath. Where we're heading for the second half of our program is that we're going to be asking specific questions to each of these panelists who are before us today. And Dr. Bill Reed, who is head of cardiovascular disease at the University of Kansas Medical Center, is going to be joining me in asking these questions. He's going to ask our first two questions. Bill?
Thank you, Adam. Myra, the first question that I have directed to you is that there's been a lot of talk about death panels and the end-of-life issues and the fear people have that if the government is involved in health care, they might have a vested interest in seeing patients choose to hasten their death. Could you address these questions for us? Is there a problem with the way the proposed bill is written that makes it flow to that kind of concerning conclusion?
I'd be glad to talk about this. The Center for Practical Bioethics has worked on and promoted advanced care planning for our entire history, which is 25 years. What the legislation, this is actually contained in the House bill, what was called the Tri-Committee bill. What the legislation actually proposes is reimbursement for primary care providers to talk with their patients, their Medicare patients, about the importance of advanced care planning, thinking about their goals and their values and what's important to them at the end of life in the event that they can no longer speak for themselves, and the importance of naming a proxy to act on their behalf in the event that that should occur. Now, physicians are not mandated to do this, and they are paid to do it whether or not the patient actually decides to execute an advance directive. Now, Sam and I were just talking. This has been so perverted and so distorted that it, in a way, I said in the paper Sunday before last, it really breaks my heart. There are three groups of people, I think, people who've really been confused by all of this, and the legislation is complicated. The language is confusing. I admit that. There are people who've been fearful of it because, I think, of a lot of rhetoric that has been used to talk about bureaucrats telling you what you have to choose at the end of life, people trying to use this as a way to legalize euthanasia. I am very opposed to the legalization of euthanasia. I know that there are people who in this country who are for assisted suicide and people who are against it. I happen to be one of those people who is opposed to it. And then there are political opportunists who have seen this as a portal through which they could enter and frighten frail, elderly, and sick people. I have no regard for them at all. I think they're a bunch of skunks, and they ought to be called out on this. However, I stand by the notion that we know what people want at the end of life. We've got mountains of data about this. They want their wishes known and honored, and they want to be treated as spiritual beings at the end of life, and they want their families cared for and supported. I don't care what anyone wants. If they want it all, that's marvelous. Sam will point out that it's very hard to imagine a healthcare system where we can pay for it all. But the reality is that we know, given options, that's not what Americans want. Most Americans want good palliative care, and they want hospice, when in fact they know that they fought the good fight and that they're not going to be able to be cured. All of us want curative measures when there's hope for life, when there's hope for cure. But I think most of us have come to realize that we are mortal. I heard the other day that someone's, let me make this one point and I'll turn it over to you, Adam. I heard someone say that that the Canadian system was so bad that one person out of five died because of the Canadian system, whether you're for the Canadian system or not. Another panelist said, excuse me, madam, but I believe you're wrong. I believe five out of five people in the Canadian system die. All of us will die. So we need to prepare for that eventuality.
Thank you very
much. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you, Laura. Sam, the most of us know, but maybe not in detail, that the hospitals lose money on Medicare. And the assuming that Congress were to pass a health care reform bill, what impact could that have on your hospital? And are there provisions that would need to be included in a health care reform package that would prevent a negative impact on hospitals?
Well, first of all, I have no idea what is in the health care reform bill. I have an idea what's currently being proposed, but it changes all the time. So from what I understand, the first go at it, there was a proposal to balance this whole issue greatly on the backs of hospitals. I think there was about a $950 billion reduction in payment or other savings over 10 years. I'm not sure if that's still in it, but anyone who practices medicine knows that if you cut Medicare and Medicaid by billions of dollars, there's no margin left there at all, if there ever was one. And hospitals have very little margin. So I'm concerned about looking at taking away from hospitals more reimbursement in the national health care plans or Medicare or Medicaid. The things that need to be included in the health care reform package from a more positive standpoint, I harp back to the fact that everyone should be covered, but it should be at a rate that doctors and hospitals can continue to invest in good health care. There is no way that we can provide really good health care without investment in information systems. And we have already, as a hospital, spent about $15 billion over the last 3 years, $15 million, rather, over the last 3 years. There has to be tort reform because, we just don't have the ability within our payment system to continually practice defensive medicine. There has to be a recognition that
mental health is just as important as physical health, and in many, many ways you can't have one without the other. So there has to be more attention spent paid to mental health. And really, I think some ways we actually spend money really foolishly within Medicare. It amazes me that you see elderly folks bouncing back and forth from the home to the hospital, either because of confusion about their medicine or just in-home accidents, and there is a restriction on home health care. I think there needs to be more emphasis on after you get to a certain age or you have a certain diagnosis, that we spend a little bit of money on home health care to make sure that that rebound doesn't keep occurring.
Thank you, Sam. This question is for Rick. Rick, I was recently in the hospital or at the doctor's office, sent to the hospital for diagnosis, and I got the medical bill. It was $6,209 for the tests and for my afternoon in the hospital. But by the time I received my actual bill after the health insurance had kicked in and the negotiated or discounted rates, what I actually paid was $1,070. And so the bill was for $6,209, but what I actually paid was $1,070, and the health insurance didn't pay anything. So that was I hadn't met my high deductible yet. So I received an 82% discount off of the published rate on these things. If I had no health insurance, I would have gone to the doctors. I would have had those tests if I thought I could. I would have received the bill for $6,209 and been expected to pay it. And so one of my questions is, for people who are low-income workers, people who have no health insurance, is there a way for them to be able to get access to the same rates that I'm paying, you know, so that they're not being billed $6,209 when they're the least able to afford that, but could they be billed the $1,070 under some proviso, cost the government nothing, and yet allows them to receive the 82% discount that I receive with health insurance?
Great question. Sounds like you've got a shrewd negotiator on your behalf to get the 82% discount. I'm going to tee this up, and then I'm going to turn to the expert. I'm going to flip this Sam's direction, so heads up, here it comes. My belief here, Adam, is that a provider, and let's take Sam's organization, they need a certain amount of money to provide the quality services that we expect. And the way the current structure is set, let's take insurance payment as the level. They're going to get those reimbursements which are subsidizing other payments. So Medicare roughly will be 20% or thereabouts less than that number. Medicaid will be 40-50% less than that number. You have your indigent care that you're caring for. So collectively, and this is an oversimplification, there are numerous billing charts, maybe one starting point in retail, but depending on what type of insurance you have, there are absolutely many, many different outcomes. And I will turn it to Sam to ask specifically to your question, what's possible?
I'm glad this question came up because I honestly believe, and you can test me on this with your thousands of members, but I don't believe if you came to Shawnee Mission Medical Center with that and you didn't have insurance that you would be charged the $6,000. We start from the standpoint of what insurance pays, and then based on your income, we move it back and forth. I believe that's the case, and it's been that way for years. So, you know, I just don't think I know we don't practice that way, Adam, where just because you don't have insurance, you know, we take advantage of you. It's just the opposite.
We have had situations where individuals have chosen not to have insurance, were fairly well off, and have come to us and said, could you solve this problem for me? And more often than not, the hospital has said, you pay the retail charges. So there absolutely is some risks to individuals, particularly if you have means, that you may end up paying retail charges.
Okay. Dr. Richardson, Rich, I'd like to ask you a question. Often I hear people say we already have health coverage for everyone in America. It's the emergency room. And so as I think about health care and your role in the ER, is it an accurate statement to say that for 47 million Americans, they can receive their health care needs met through the emergency room?
No. This,
That is the short answer, Adam. Now, there is EMTALA law. There is a law that states that if you, as a patient, perceive that there is a threat to life or limb, you are entitled to a medical screening exam, and you have to be examined in the emergency department. Completely irrelevant, nothing to do with your ability to pay. That's good, but it's also being very abused right now. A number of people have caught on to that and now are using the emergency department as the primary care. I want to build on that, though, because that sounds kind of harsh, and I don't mean it to sound that way. Emergency medicine is just that, urgent, critical care of a life-threatening or potentially life-threatening condition. It is episodic care. If you come to my emergency department, most likely you don't know me, and I can pretty well assure you that, except with those maybe members of the church, I don't know you. So I have to learn a whole lot in 2 to 3, maybe 5 minutes at the most. Whereas your primary care provider knows you, knows your medical history. The problem is that everybody is responsible for this problem, including physicians. The reason why a number of patients come to see me is because they can't get into their physician. It's amazing that the change in conditions of a patient come 3 p.m. on Friday. The physician's offices start closing down and the patients get directed towards me. So it's episodic care. That's not the best care for you. For a specific problem, yes, but not for your general care. Secondly, it's very expensive. We have to staff for the worst. 24/7, 365, we have to be ready to go. That's a very expensive proposition. We're forced to do a lot of testing in a very short time because we have a very brief time with you, so it's a very expensive way of doing it. Number three, it drains resources. When I'm taking care of a trivial condition that could be cared for in a routine, more effective manner by a primary care provider, that's draining our resources to be available for a critical patient that would come in. Primary care physicians have to take more ownership for this. And there's what a term called now medical home that's being tossed around. It's not exactly like a HMO, which has a bad connotation, but what it means is these physicians are truly availing themselves to you. What they do is they partner with other physicians, and so they're available to you 24 hours a day, and you get to know that physician. You have a contact, and therefore you're not forced to come to the emergency department. So there is something that we as physicians can improve on.
Thank you.
Brenda, the question is often asked, is health care usually defined as the prevention, treatment, and management of illness and the preservation of mental and physical well-being through the services of physicians and others in the healthcare field? Should healthcare be a basic right in our country? And allow me to make the question a bit more challenging. We know people need food and shelter, so they have access to grocery stores and a variety of housing options, but we don't simply give them food and housing. How is healthcare different from this?
Well, I believe we have a moral obligation to provide quality healthcare to every person that needs it, regardless of whether they carry that laminated card in their pocket. And we heard an interesting speaker this morning, a few of us, that talked about one of the reasons why this debate has become so rancorous is because in America, we like to own what we have. We like to have it. And when we have our card and we know what it says and we finally figured out, no offense, Keith, our policy, and what might be covered on this visit or here or there, we are really reluctant to throw it onto the table with everybody else's cards and draw a new one out because we're not quite sure what we're going to get. And I think that it's safe to say that our foundation believes there has to be at least a basic level of understandable coverage for people in this country. Rick referenced his children, and he worries about them and the debt that they'll carry. I worry about my child who has a pre-existing condition. When he rolls off my policy, what will he get? What will he be able to get in this country in about 10 to 15 years? A child who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, will she ever, through no fault of her own, be able to obtain coverage in this country? I worry about the folks, and I would guess I could ask for a show of hands. There are probably a few of you who have adult children returning from college, who maybe haven't found a job yet and they've rolled off your plan. Where do they find coverage? And again, I think another point I want to make here in terms of whether this is a need or a right, and it's sort of related, is that coverage also doesn't always equal access. Just because we have insurance doesn't mean it's enough sometimes to get what we need. We may lack the catastrophic coverage. Our deductibles or premiums may, or our deductibles and copays may be so high, we're unable to do that, or we make choices. Health savings accounts work great for some percentage of the population, but for a person who has a chronic illness and can't decide to defer care, they may not be a very good option. So I think this debate around whether health care is a right, I do believe it's a moral obligation. I would like to see it treated more like we have other public services where we've decided that this is America and everybody deserves at least some aspect of health care, much as we do with education and fire and police and our roads. We have a lot of those good things in Johnson County. We also have the second highest number of uninsured in this county. We have 47,000 people in Johnson County who don't have insurance. That's second only to Sedgwick. Our neighbors in Wyandotte have the highest percentage of uninsured in the state of Kansas. So to me, this is about a very now issue, and I think we do have a moral obligation to take a look at that.
Thank you, Brenda. This question is for Keith Wisdom. Keith, I've heard the President and members of Congress mention that any government option would need to allow private health insurers to compete. So there's this talk of a public option, and they've likened the competition to the U.S. Postal Service and FedEx and UPS, and said those two are able to compete with the Postal Service, and so a government option would need to be something that companies like yours could continue to compete with. And so assuming for a moment that Congress does pass a health care reform bill in the next year, what would a government option need to look like so that it actually helped helped companies like yours to be able to compete with it, to stay in business, in essence? Yeah.
Good question, Adam. The first problem to try to answer that is to know what a government option would look like. And I think there isn't a commonly accepted specific definition, since so many proposals are running around in Washington right now. Also, co-ops have come into the conversation. Those haven't been defined. I debated with people on my management team this afternoon what they meant, and we didn't agree. So to answer how we would compete with them is hard because we don't know what they are yet. But the thing I can say is I cannot imagine how a public option could be administered in a way that would create a level playing field with the existing health insurers in the industry. We are heavily regulated. We have to make profits in order to fund reserves, in order to meet the state insurance regulations. A public option wouldn't have to make profits. It wouldn't have to create reserves and operate under the same regulations that we do. They would have the benefit of lower admin costs, but by the virtue of the federal government absorbing some of those. Many of the current discussions center around provider reimbursement levels close to the Medicare level for that public option, which you've heard some of the providers talk about how that's close to their cost level. We don't enjoy those sorts of reimbursement rates. We pay higher for the same reasons that have been discussed earlier. And so if we're paying higher for the same services and we have to make a profit to fund reserves and we have higher admin costs, I don't see an equation where we can keep offering you the same health insurance your employer can purchase today or you purchase as an individual with the same benefits and the same cost structure. We just can't win that game long term. We would go out of business. So we're going to have to change what we do. I don't want to start rhetoric and guessing what the change is going to be and say, well, I'll be out of business. But I know we'll be different. We won't offer you the same plans. I can't imagine. I can't say that for sure, but I can't imagine how we can offer you the same plans and survive long term. And so the idea that you would still have, if you like your insurance today, you can have it tomorrow if this passes, I strongly disagree with that statement. I don't think that the system will be the same. There's also studies that suggest there will be a large shift of members to a public plan because small employers who can barely afford insurance are going to say, great, let the government cover that. And that takes their money out of the system that's helping pay for it now. And the final thing is our profit margins in the insurance industry are challenged constantly that we think we're making gross profits. And so I did some study. I went to Schwab.com this week, and the highest for a national health insurance, the highest profit margin that they had that was posted was in the high 4% range, and most of them were less than 4%, which are similar profit margins to hospitals and other people in the community. And I'm sure nobody agrees on what's the right profit margin, but I don't think those would be excessive.
Thank you, Keith. This question is for Hilda. Hilda, I here in Kansas City, most of the hospitals formed before 1950 were formed by church-related groups. St. Luke's, St. Joseph's, Baptist Medical Center, Shawnee Mission Medical Center, a host of others. So from time to time I'll have people say to me, you know, the church needs to, I mean, really we don't want the government involved in solving the problem for healthcare. Really the churches ought to solve this problem. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about that? And do you think churches, is this something that churches can do today? Can churches solve the healthcare problem?
Well, when I think of the church, I think of the people that are out here. I don't think of a structure. That's the church are the people. And if you think in terms of the complexity of this conversation, running a healthcare organization is about a million times more complex. And there's clearly a role for the church. More and more church-based or religious-based health institutions are moving away from that health ministry. It's the folks that are truly entrenched, that truly believe that it is a ministry that have really stayed behind, like Shawnee Mission and St. Joseph's are two that really, how can I say this, show their faith on their arm sleeves. The others, many others, truly believe it's a business, and they run like a business, and you already heard Sam Turner say, well, you know, we do ours on a sliding scale, and we take care of the poor, we take care of the indigent. St. Luke's will say the same. But there is clearly a role for the church, the people in the church. Now, remember that there's a large unchurched group out there, but in terms of the people who are in a church community, in a religious or a spiritual community, there's education that can be done. There's health screening. There's support groups. There's visitation, the socialization, particularly for the elderly. We thought my mom was going to die. And when she got her home health aid and started getting that socialization in place, 5 years later, she's going to live longer than I do. She's going to live longer than we all are going to live. I mean, people don't think about what the elderly really need is that connection sometimes. You know, the transportation to and from the clinics and to the doctor's appointments and the telephone trees to make sure. Healthcare is so complex. It really is just a business specialty unto itself. It needs to be run like a business in order for it to be successful. The church clearly plays a role in making sure that there's a mind, body, spirit connection in everything that we do. The church plays a role in making sure that we are caring for one another as we have been asked to do, and to engage and to hold the other healthcare institutions who profess to do the work of Jesus Christ and hold them accountable for providing excellent healthcare services to everyone in need.
Thank you, Hilda.
A question to direct to Sam and to Rich. We already recognize that we have some shortages in physician coverage, particularly in primary care. How would we solve the potential problems of a marked increase in the population that needs that type of service?
Well, since you've asked both of us, do we get 6 minutes instead of three? No. Okay. I'll go first then. You know, I think the irony of here this is if we improve the health care benefits of insurance, I think what you'll see is just the opposite. I think you'll see patient volumes go down because now patients have better access to the physicians, which means better preventive care. They'll be cured for earlier and therefore maybe will ward off getting as ill requiring hospitalization. So that actually hopefully will reduce cost and actually reduce inpatient time, I would hope. Second thing is what we have to do, and I want to reemphasize what Rick said here, is we have to change our paradigm in medical schools. We don't have to put out more primary care physicians. The way it is right now, let's look at KU. What an incredible medical facility we have there. Every subspecialty known to mankind is at that medical center. But if you're primary care, if you're a family physician doing your residency there, if someone has chest pain, you refer them to the cardiologist. If they have tingling in the wrist, you send them to a neurologist. If their tummy hurts, they go to a gastroenterologist. Well, if that's the way you learn family practice, once you get out in the real world, what do? You start referring off. So there is something else that we as physicians can do is changing our training. I think we're gaining as far as physician extenders, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. And the last thing is we have to embrace technology. Telemedicine has a wonderful opportunity here to expand the resources of a physician where he or she could sit in front of a console and serve maybe 10 rural emergency departments at once with very low volume, but yet that puts an emergency physician in every department. So there are opportunities there.
There are more and more physicians, particularly primary care doctors, who are opting out of taking more Medicare patients. So coverage is not the main answer. Covering more folks will not necessarily make doctors overburdened. If it's done right, it could actually incentivize folks to go to school, graduate as primary care doctors or other doctors. If it's done wrong, and there is not good reimbursement, and I'm not talking about extravagant reimbursement, but at least covering costs, then it will create a problem like we have now. I never thought I would see the day when physicians, even in rural areas, are putting a cap on the number of Medicare patients that they're willing to see because it won't cover their costs.
Thank you. Okay. We're getting ready to wrap up, and you're going to each have 3 minutes to share with us what you most want us to remember from you before we leave tonight. What we've done is we've just scratched the surface. What I've wanted you to understand or to recognize is all of these folks favor some kind of healthcare reform. The question is, exactly what does that look like? How do we get at it? How do we fund it? Who's covered, how it's administered? But everyone here says there's something that needs to change. There's some things that need to be addressed. We can do this better, with better outcomes and with more people covered. Each person I think I heard say that there are people who need to be covered who are not currently covered. We haven't given you the solution. They haven't given you the solution. But they have helped you think about some possible solutions. And in essence, we've scratched the surface. But the other thing I want you to notice is we've done this without scratching each other's eyes out, without hurting each other, calling each other names, and without disparaging one another. And I think if these folks can do this, and for some of them, their jobs, their futures, their careers, you know, are bound up in this, then surely the rest of us can talk about this in a way that reflects civility and a willingness to listen and to understand and to show respect for other people. And that's part of what this was about today, was beginning to understand the issues and understanding some of the solutions, but also learning how to talk about a very controversial issue in ways that allows us to listen and learn from one another. So with that said, we're going to take the last few minutes of our time together and allow each of you to say, here's what's most important to me in the conversation about healthcare reform. And we're going to begin with you, Sam.
Since we just have a few minutes, I'm going to try to make it succinct. And that is that I really believe that we can solve this issue if we're honest and open in our conversation. Political jargon, vilifying doctors, vilifying hospitals are whatever political party is not going to get answered. I am concerned about the 2,800 employees at Shawnee Mission Medical Center and the 700 doctors. But that does not prevent me from recognizing the fact that what we have is not working for everyone. But what I would like to see is continued dialogue like this. So I think as open as we can be about solving this issue, not necessarily rushing to a conclusion because of a timetable, but just doing it right the first time.
A couple of years ago, a good friend of my daughter's that she had gone to high school with went out on his own to start a business. He had been a high school football player and was president of his class, went to KU and pledged a fraternity and had gone to work in an advertising business, done very well, married, had three little kids, but he wanted to do even better and wanted to have even more for his family. So he decided to start his own business, a commercial real estate business, and didn't think in startup that they could afford the health care premiums. They decided to take catastrophic coverage, what we, when I was growing up, would have called major medical, but thought they could handle the out-of-pocket expenses for just the routine stuff. And before he turned 40, he started having some funky symptoms and went to his doctor, a good person, who said, you know, you need to have an MRI. And he asked what it cost. And when the doctor told him what the MRI cost, he said, I think I'm just getting old. You know, I'm getting ready to turn 40. I don't think I'm going to do that. He didn't have the MRI, and he went along, and things got a little bit worse. And he finally told his wife what was going on. And she said, you know, this is crazy. You're going to have the MRI. And actually, his friends gave him the MRI for his 40th birthday. He had metastatic advanced stage cancer. His friends rallied around him, and they created four teams. And they met every Saturday morning. There was one team that made sure he always had someone to take him to the doctor. And when he was in the hospital, he was never alone. Another team that made sure his kids got to soccer and dance and didn't get left behind. Another team who took care of the house, did the laundry, made meals, mowed the yard. And another team that convened a weekly prayer meeting by conference call. I sat in on one of the prayer meetings. A sister, a Roman Catholic sister, convened the prayer meetings, and she announced that day that there were more than 1,000 people who had logged in on the call in a number of countries around the world. Everybody loved this kid. But even with prayers and teams and lots of love, they couldn't save him, and he didn't live to be 41 years old. I tell you that story because this is not about them. This is about us. This is about our kids. This is about hardworking people who really are the best among us. So I hope that we can find it within us to have these conversations and to figure out a way to fix this.
The number one thing I want everyone to take away is that there's consensus from all sides of the fence, at least if all sides of the fence are represented here, that reform is needed, healthcare reform is needed. I personally believe the worst outcome that could happen in Washington this year is that nothing happens and we walk away from addressing the long-term issues of our healthcare system in America. And so that's the number one wish I have for this whole process is that there is reform. Some highlights of the things that I think are important with that are expanding some of the government programs like Medicaid and SCHIP to cover the neediest people, provide support, phased out support at higher income levels for people who can't afford their full insurance premiums. Again, change the insurance dynamics so pre-existing conditions and health status does not prevent people from getting insurance, and then put everybody in the insurance pool. And we go a long way to solving these problems. And finally, there's a lot of discussion that's about things we can change in the system to save money. And my company has a center for health reform and modernization that it started up. And they've done a couple of papers on practical ways we can save billions of dollars over the next decade. And these are just things going on in private insurance that if we apply them to our Medicaid and Medicaid Medicare and Medicaid programs, we can save billions of dollars. One paper talked about some of the clinical programs and care management programs and that approaches that are currently going on with commercial health care. If we put them in Medicare and Medicaid with phased-in savings, so it's not oversimplifying and overestimating it, at least over $500 billion. And then if we use, in another paper, if we use technology and simplify the administrative hassles we have in the healthcare system, we can save over $300 billion. So in a couple of papers, we have some ideas that are well in excess of $800 billion over the next decade. They're not all the perfect answers, but they're a long ways, they're a huge start in solving it. And I think we're all willing to work together in this industry with some common sense solutions that build on the great things in the healthcare system today and eliminate some of the greatest weaknesses we have there.
Thank you, Keith. Hilda?
I heard today on National Public Radio that people who have been unemployed are during this recession are having difficulty finding work, which takes us back to what I had heard earlier about this being a jobless recovery. And the faces, so that means that the faces of the uninsured have changed. We would normally think of them as the poor, and it's no longer like that. The people that come into our waiting room at the health center are driving for many, many miles. They're farmers. You can see it in how they dress. Our health center was normally we would see people from different countries or African American or Hispanic, and now we're seeing many, many more Caucasians. And the people that come to us work in multiple part-time jobs, and their insurance, employer doesn't provide insurance. They're working poor or they're unemployed. They're not lazy people. I'm not a lazy person. I am going to have problems eventually paying for my medicines and my co-pays and things of that nature. We are talking about people who are just like us. It's not them anymore. It is us. It's your children. And it's a difficult situation for all of us. All it needs to do is affect one member of your family or yourself, and you'll really understand what it feels like. Or just spend an hour at my health center. I invite you. It's at 825 Euclid Avenue. Just come and visit, and you'll get a sense of what that really looks like, at least. But I'm going to leave you with just one question. And that is, what is the value of life?
Thank you, Heather. Rick?
Wrapping up a number of things that I've heard today and things I believe is that we are, in fact, committed to spend enough money to provide, I think, better health care, to achieve the goals that we've talked about, to increase quality, to increase the number of people that are covered under insurance. And I think we need to have a serious dialogue, as Sam said, an honest dialogue about the true cost drivers. We need to talk about tort reform. We need to talk about waste and inefficiencies in the system. We need to talk about modernizing the healthcare system. We need to realize that there are various stakeholders. I heard somebody say today, one person's waste and inefficiencies is somebody else's revenue bucket. We need to understand and appreciate that. But I would contend that we need to figure out a way within our current spending environment to accomplish those goals, and I do believe it can be done.
Thank you. Brenda?
I want to end with just a quick story about one of the clinics we support with grantee funds and technical assistance. Turner House Children's Clinic in Kansas City, Kansas is a safety net healthcare clinic targeted primarily at children. It provides close to 7,000 patient visits a year. 46% of the clinic's patients are uninsured. The rest are Medicaid. And on almost every weekday morning when those clinic doors open, there's a line of people waiting down the hall to get in the doors. These families, as Hilda referenced, are hardworking families. They're trying very hard to do the best by their children. And to do that, they get in line to obtain health care. And Sam referenced that in a new health care environment, we are going to have to give some things up, and that some rationing of some sort will logically have to take place. I would argue that we already ration health care in this country, and we ration it by whether or not you can pay for it or not. The safety net clinics, I've heard a lot of folks say, well, we have these great safety net clinics, uninsured people can go there. We fund all of the clinics in town, and I can assure you that they do not have the capacity even to meet the numbers of patients they are currently seeing, much less the huge numbers of uninsured that are calling into them every day at this point in our economy and lack of recovery. But neither can the foundations. Neither can the churches, neither can the hospitals or the insurance companies. This is going to be a massive negotiation and collaboration, and it will not be perfect, but let's not let perfect be the enemy of good. We are going to have to start somewhere. We are going to have to do something because our current model of healthcare in this country is absolutely unsustainable. Wages at this point are actually health premiums outpace wages in the state of Kansas 5-1 now. So you don't have to do the math. Every one of you who pays for health coverage for your employees knows you wait for every year to see what the rates are going to go up this year. And when you're talking 10% and 15% and 20%, those are costs that can't be sustainable in our old environment, much less our current environment. So let's not let perfect be the enemy of good. Let's get started and tackle the things that we do have agreement on and begin to work and negotiate on those other aspects as we move forward.
Thank you, Brenda. Rich?
Well, first of all, Adam, I'm humbled that you thought I was worthy to be up here with such an esteemed panel. I'm not so sure that turned out to be so, but thank you. I also want to thank all of you for coming tonight. You know, I worked on these answers, but when the spotlights come on and I have this clock in front of me, suddenly my memory gets a little shaky, so if I stumbled up during this evening, I apologize to you. You know, when we think about this thing called health care reform, I think about a movie we just had a sermon on, The Wizard of Oz and the Scarecrow. And the Scarecrow points in different directions. It's her fault, it's his fault, it's their fault. It's all our faults. Every one of us, the physicians, the hospitals, the insurance companies, the plaintiff's attorneys, we all have to take ownership in this, as do you, the consumer. I want to commend President Obama for bringing this to the forefront. We've talked about it in passing, but he is really holding our feet to the fire. I think what frightens many people is the speed of it. This has taken generations to get into this problem. We're not going to get out of it by the end of August, and I think that's what worries a lot of people. We just can't fix this behemoth in a matter of months, or it's going to be over time. I just encourage you to take ownership for your own, for your health, you know, healthy lifestyles, and be realistic in what can be provided to you. Do you realize that for a pharmaceutical company to bring one pill, one product to market, it costs them about $1 billion? So the more we expect, the more it's going to cost. Please understand that we're physicians. We really are doing the best we can. But I'm not perfect. I'm not perfect. Do you know that my emergency group pays almost $2,000 a day in medical malpractice premiums? So we're doing the best we can. But if we don't get a handle on tort reform, and especially if the plaintiff's attorneys get their way, right now they have it before the Kansas Supreme Court that they're going to pull back on the caps on pain and suffering, suddenly $2,000 a day will look cheap. But again, I think the most important thing here is that we're talking about it. Talk to your senators, talk to your representatives, talk to your physicians, encourage them to be more available. Take ownership for your health. Be advocates. And by you being here tonight, there's clearly evidence of that. So maybe the greatest applause deserves to be to you for coming tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. You have been a tremendous audience. No shouts, no signs, no standing up and making a huff. Nobody. I didn't see anybody have to go out and have a cup of coffee out in the narthex. And so I want to commend you for sitting and listening and just being here. The fact that you showed up says that you care enough about what's happening in our world. And for those of you who are part of our congregation and those of you who are watching online who are people of faith, to say, you know, I think this has something to do with my faith. I believe somehow my faith is intertwined with how I look at solving these important problems. This is an important issue. And the folks who have who you've heard from today talked about this is sort of not just them, it's us. I have probably a dozen emails from people in our congregation, some of whom, if I said their names, you'd be surprised, who do not have health insurance right now. Pre-existing conditions, other situations, been out of work for some time. And, you know, they're writing and saying, you know, this isn't just about somebody someplace else. This is about me. And these are people who volunteer every week. They're actively involved in the church. This is us. And so I want to encourage you to take the time to read, study. I mean, we just scratched the surface, but to read, study, pray, and to try to understand what's going on, not just to react out of fear. I mean, it's so easy for us to react out of fear when we talk about change. We hate change. We want things to stay the same. And there comes a certain point where we have to say, there's something that needs to change. We have to be willing to look at what are the solutions, and not just to react out of fear, but to react out of really thoughtful dialogue and discussion, and you've been a part of that tonight. I want to ask you to please join me in thanking our panelists and Dr. Reed. You really have been a great blessing and a wonderful gift to us. Thank you for the time that you've given to us today. I'd like to invite us to stand for our closing prayer. I also want to mention to those who are watching online that we'll be posting this on the internet. You can also purchase this on DVD. You can contact our church through our website. So it'll be posted online. We'll make it available on DVD for you to show to your small groups, your Sunday school classes across the country. We have people across the country and a few around the world who are joining us for this conversation today. Let's bow in prayer. Lord, thank you for each person who came to listen to this and to be a part of the conversation, who cared enough and who recognized that their faith has something to do with the issue of access to health care for all people. We recognize your heart breaks for people who are struggling, some of whom are a part of our own congregations. We pray that you would grant us all wisdom and understanding that we might together be a part of the solution and not merely complaining or even silent about the problem. Grant wisdom to our leaders in Congress, wisdom to our president. Bless each of these panelists in the work that they do, and help us, O Lord, to not simply be concerned for our own interests, but to look out for the interest of others in this important discussion. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you, and God bless you.